Well, it's great to be home. I feel like I've come home. Don't clap, I may go home. It's so special to be at Steve Zeisler's retirement here, and I was sitting over there and was a bit overwhelmed at God's faithfulness to Steve and to me as we were kind of co-workers together. And I think of kind of the sovereignty of God. My whole life's been a gift. Nothing I planned, and just something you walk into. One of the most monumental movements of God was bringing me to Northern California for college. My school of choice from age 0 to 18 was USC. And I had a full scholarship there in gymnastics and was all ready to go. And my sister says, well, why don't you just apply to Stanford and see if you can get in? And I didn't know Stanford existed. But I thought, what the heck, and a gymnastics coach brought me up, and I got in, and back then you could get in with an SAT score of 470 at 800 in English. I have ADD and poor vocabulary and don't have a memory, but I guess they like the jock. And when I was on the campus, I just felt the Lord was calling me to the campus. And I had become a Christian the year before, and my mom was pretty upset, and she kind of cornered me. She says, if you told your dad where you're going to go, he's got to pay for this. So I was terrified to tell my dad, and he goes, I don't care where you go. And so when I came up, Steve Zeisler was the first Christian I met. He came into my dorm and kind of embraced me, and then it was Dave Roper. And I joined a frat house because I was raised with women. I had three older sisters. And I was all boy, and my dad wasn't at home, and I couldn't wait to be with guys. So I joined a frat house, and I asked David to teach a Bible study in the fraternity. And he said, no. And I said, what do you mean, no? He says, no, I'm going to teach you, and you're going to teach it. And I was terrified. I said, I don't know anything. He says, no problem. He says, you're going to invite me to dinner next week. We're going to have a team meeting. You're going to share your faith. I'm going to share the gospel. You're going to announce you're going to teach a Bible study every Tuesday. And I didn't sleep for a week. So he would come up in his little red Volkswagen up to the Theta Delta house and open up the Gospel of John, and I'd furiously take notes. And I prayed that four guys had come to Christ. There were no Christians in the house except one guy. And four guys came to Christ. And David taught me John, and then he taught me Romans. And then I went overseas to Italy for 6 months. And I felt the pressure of God to teach again. And I thought, no, Lord, not here. But the pressure wouldn't go away, so one night I grabbed the microphone. This is with 80 students, no Christians. And they're all there to party and drop acid and marijuana and protest. And I said, I'd like to start a Bible study. And 15 people showed up, and it was life-changing for me. And so at the end of it all, I said, my dad paid $20,000 for a PBC education. And so at the end of it, I decided I wanted to intern here instead of going to business school. And my parents were devastated. The wall went up for 20 years, and then I came an intern. After I interned, I decided, well, I really want to do this pastor thing, and I want an education, so I applied to Dallas Seminary 2 years in a row, got in twice, but the elder said, why don't you stay here, and we'll give you all the seminary training you want while you're a pastor. I had no idea how they were going to do that, but I took them up on their offer, and I wouldn't have traded the education I got. That's when they brought Bud Ortlund on the staff to teach Greek and Hebrew, and he would tutor us and what he was teaching the interns. And then, of course, Ray kind of adopted me like a son and took me all over the country to these meetings with scholars, and I became a scholar stalker. And so if I found someone, I just became friends with them and would weave my way into their lives, and they'd give me all their stuff, and they became my friends. And then traveling with Ray and the team here was like nothing. No education could have given us, from going to Africa to Indonesia, to Israel, Malaysia, Australia, with this band of motley, crazy people, from Ritchie to Stedman to Winslow, and the irreverence and the fun and the ministry was just incredible. And so it was just a gift. And so my education I didn't even pay for. I'm still getting a free ride with people I steal their notes from. And then the Lord gave the next gift was PBC Cupertino. Now, I didn't want to go to Cupertino. I wanted to stay here. I love college kids. So passionate, because you change college kids' lives, you change them for life. You build good marriages. You teach them to be evangelists and to be a bit nuts and crazy. And so I really didn't want to go to Cupertino to be confined to some building. But nobody asked me where I wanted to go. And Winslow just said, come down here and teach for 12 weeks. And so I did. And then at the end, it was obvious I couldn't teach there and have a ministry at Stanford. So I left the campus, and I grieved for a whole summer. It was really hard for me to leave that ministry. But then God gave me a new gift, and it was the gift of poetry. I'd never taken a poetry class in my life. I thought poets were weird. I can't read them. But God took me to Romania to meet a poet in 1988 during communist Ceausescu era. And everything we were going to do was illegal, teaching the scriptures for a week to people who were giving their lives for it in the forest, hidden in homes, and so on. And it was interesting when I heard these people sing. These people had their ration 5 eggs a month. You show up at breakfast, you get 2 of those eggs on your plate. Their kids won't eat because they're serving you like Jesus. Their ration is a few millimeters of meat. Ceausescu had exported the whole food supply to pay the national debt, isolated the country for all the years. They only got 2 hours of TV was Ceausescu being paraded around the fields, everybody applauding him. And these Christians were loving you. But when they sang, it's as if they got into Eliza's chariot and they started going up higher with each verse. And then at one point in the hymn, they got underneath God's throne. And you could tell they were there because they all stopped in silence and they all started weeping. And then they would jump in the chariot again and come back down. And I thought to myself, who wrote these songs? And it turned out to be a poet who was in prison for 17 years. Securitate took 25 years of his poems, put him in an ox cart, burned it in front of his eyes, threw him in prison, beat him to a pulp. And in prison, he had his memory. And your memory becomes more acute in suffering. And each day, he'd find a little glass shard, and he had a rag, and he wiped the lime off the walls and spit, and he made a palette, and with a toothpick, he recreated a poem on that palette and memorized it. Day one. Day two, do the same thing. After 30 days, he'd have 30 poems. How many poems he reclaimed? 17 years, he reclaimed 4,500 poems. And when I got there, they were published in a hymnal, about 1,000 pages, very few of them, and so I was just amazed. Well, then one day I met him. I came to my room after a secret meeting, and he's standing in my bedroom. He's about this tall. He was a peasant. His name was Triandors. And I felt that feeling that Peter had when Jesus was in the boat, and he says, depart from me, for I'm unclean. And you had the sense of unworthiness, but his eyes of love kind of drew you while your own sense repelled you. And he looked at me, and he grabbed me, looked me in the eye, and he said to me, you teach about the cross. We live under the cross. And I felt about that big. And I went to my room that night, and well, then he prayed for me, and these Romanian cadences just tore my heart like water, and I knew what he was praying. He was praying I would know something of the presence of Christ that he knew through suffering. So I woke up that night asking the Lord, just give me a tenth of his spirit. So I took one of the hymnals and asked one of the guys, if you give me a hymnal, I will publish it. I don't know how. But how do you get it out of the country? So I stuck it inside my sleeping bag, and you go to cross the border, and it was just like, you know, Checkpoint Charlie in Berlin. They take apart the train car. They pull out the seats. They bring in the dogs. You hear people screaming who are trying to escape. And they went through all my luggage, but they didn't touch the sleeping bag. So I got it out. And we had a Jew in our congregation who was so appreciative of Romania, he published 20,000 copies at a buck apiece. So how do you get them back in the country? We got one out. How do you get 20,000 back in? So we put it in a semi. We drove it across Europe. And it was December 1989 as the revolution was happening. There was so much chaos at the border, nobody looked at the truck. And when we handed out these hymnals, it was like you're giving people gold. They are weeping. And when I came back, I thought, we are missing something in the West. And I loved teaching Psalms, and I loved Hebrew. And I had found the power of story while I was here. And I always thought, if the Bible is God speaks to us in story, that tells us that we get to know each other through story, the R-rated version, because the Bible's about R-rated honesty. So I'd make all the guys in my group share your life story so we know you. I didn't ever know about the power of poetry. And then I discovered in the scriptures, well, it's 30% of the Old Testament. Every time God speaks to man, it's poetry. Man's first words is poetry. All prophecy's poetry. Wisdom literature's poetry. So I'm just naive. I just think if the Bible says that's the way God communicates to us, then my job as a pastor isn't just to teach, it's to turn people into storytellers and poets. That's the way we know each other at the deepest levels. And the irony is, I'm in a church full of software engineers, most of whom come through cultures where honesty is forbidden. And I think, what am I doing here behind Apple? It's been a fun deal. And the signature text that really changed my life was the text we're going to look at today. Part of my education growing up wasn't just academic, it was children. It was losing two children. And what that taught me was more than any seminary education. And I was not prepared to handle that grief because I came from a family that didn't talk. My dad was a surgeon, my mother was adopted. Hated her stepmother. I didn't know her stepmother's name. My dad was so quiet, I didn't know he had a sister till I was 13. My mother was adopted by a woman who didn't want her for her, because she was a daughter. She wanted her for her music. She was a brilliant cellist at the age of 9, had two younger sisters. I didn't find out till I was 40 this woman sexually abused the youngest daughter, which explained everything about my mother, why she couldn't forgive, why she ran away at 18 with my dad, why she couldn't talk about pain. I had two sisters, both lost their marriages in 22 days. I had a sister that was pregnant at 15, 5 months before my parents found out. They put her, had an illegal abortion under an assumed name. She almost died. My mother had a nervous breakdown. We didn't talk about it. So you can imagine, when I lost children, I had no tools to handle grief. In fact, all my dad could do when he visited is he handed me a $100 bill and he left and he couldn't stay for the funeral. And then I found these texts and the Romanians. And in 2 Samuel 1, David challenges that if you want to grow spiritually, it has everything to do with how you embrace loss and limitation and process grief. And through that process, you find a mysterious love that will keep you going and recreate your dreams after they're shattered. So David's poem is a tribute to the one who contributed most to his life, Jonathan, and what his friendship meant to him now that he is dead. And I think especially today, now that America knows we're not safe from any terrorism, and we're trying to use technology to numb our grief, we need lament more than ever before to process pain biblically. And this was a tremendous gift to me. Well, David was in Ziklag when he first got the news that King Saul was dead. Saul was decapitated. His weapons were carried off as trophies for display in the Philistine temple. And his body and the bodies of his sons were impaled to a wall in Beit Shean. And a valiant group of men from Jabesh Gilead pulled a night raid and rescued the four bodies from further defilement. They pulled them down, burned them, and gave them a proper burial. Now you would think after 13 years of being hounded by King Saul, David would put on his royal robe and dance. He can finally be king out in the open. But he doesn't. He writes this lament, and he makes sure all Israel laments with him. So how does David give voice to his grief? How do you speak of a friendship so precious, yet so short-lived, now violently ripped away? Are there words for this desecration? Now, the poem is so significant that David wrote that the editors of the canon, rather than putting it in with the Psalms, left it in the narrative portion of Scripture. And when you have poetry and narrative, it is telling you the theology of the whole story. And Samuel's based on three poems. Hannah's poem sets the stage for the whole theology of the book. David's theology here repeats her theology. And David wrote in his introduction, David lamented with his lamentation over Saul and Jonathan, his son, and he said, "Teach it to the people of Judah. Behold, it is written in the book of Jashar." You know, it is a very holy act to stand with someone in their grief. And I've come to treasure this poem for decades, not only for what it says, but how David constructed it as a tool to process his own pain. So David didn't deny his grief. He did not ignore it or bury it. He faced it. He embraced it. And the poem unfolds in very four distinct stages. So the first thing to do with grief is you have to give grief a name. That was Adam's first act in the garden. That's what makes us human. When you can name something, you can control it. That's why scientists name the bones of our bodies. They have to name a disease to understand a disease to control it. The problem is when you're overwhelmed with grief and emotions, language eludes us. And scientific language doesn't work. So David found that the secret to overcome our gaping silence was creating metaphors, concrete images from the story, and often putting opposite images together that create tension that give name to your grief. So he does this two ways at the beginning. In the first, he describes how impotent he is to prevent the inevitable. So he says, "Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult." So the opening line of the painful image of the royal crown slain on Gilboa, David cries out in anguish, "Tell it not in Gath." Israel's worst fears are realized. Her king is dead. Saul was left unprotected, abandoned, slaughtered, defiled, dismembered, and displayed by the enemy. I don't know if you can see the irony here. Saul suffered the same fate as Goliath. And where is Goliath from? Gath. And now the good news of their gospel is going to Gath, and all the Philistine daughters are rejoicing. And this has already happened when David writes this. Being a football fan, my mother said to me when I went to Stanford, "Why do you want to go to Stanford? They have a terrible football team, and their gymnastic team is terrible." And we got a new coach for gymnastics. They took Stanford from last to second in 1 year. We got the best gymnast of the country. And then Steve Zeisler went to Stanford football team, and all those other guys found out he was going. So Plunkett came, and Don Bunce came, and all the other greats came. But my sophomore year, we were playing SC. So I grabbed my then-girlfriend Emily, and we went to the game. And it was a great game. And all my fraternity brothers were there. We're all sitting. And with 50 seconds to go, we go ahead. And everybody's lighting cigars, and we're so excited. We beat them on their own turf. And then SC starts to come back. And I'm watching, and all of a sudden the clock goes to zero as the kicker kicks it, and the ball barely makes it over the goalpost. And we're stunned. And imagine, you know, 90,000 fans in the Coliseum are erupting. The most painful thing, however, when you lose, is to go to the enemy's locker room and see them celebrating. And we'd parked our car in Fraternity Row, which was now an orgy of celebration. So as I'm walking out with Emily, I can't even talk. My parents' friends were alumni. They came up to me and says, "Brian, don't feel so bad. We were praying that SC would win." I says, "What do you think I was doing?" So that rubbed it in. And then we have to walk past Tommy Trojan, that idol, and the whole band is there. They're all bowing down to the idol as if the idol Baal gave them victory. And then I look out of the corner of my eye, and there is Bruce Pelton, Emily's old boyfriend that went to USC. And he tried to take her from me that summer. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I thought, you may have won the battle, but I won the war. It's got nothing to do with the message, but I thought, I thought it was a great moment. So the second thing he says is he wants to voice the fact that he's impotent to create what he longs for. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. When you are consumed in grief, you are looking for images and things much bigger than you. I remember that when my son was dying, we were up in San Francisco, and the sun was setting, and I thought, okay, the sun's setting on my son's life. And then both times when my kids died, it was pouring rain. And you feel a comfort as if heaven is crying with you. By contrast, the day after my son, or we're leaving the hospital after David died, and everybody's on 101 going to work, and I'm thinking, how can you go to work when my son, you want the world to stop? So if Gilboa was the mountain where Saul died, David wants that mountain cursed. He wants God to create the creation to conform to his soul because the event is so huge. He doesn't want any rain there. And when you don't have any rain, you don't have any crops. When you don't have any crops, you don't have any offerings. He doesn't want any worship on that mountain. Next slide. But this is what Gilboa looks like. He can't make that happen. Elie Wiesel, you know, the best writer to come out of the Holocaust, he went out back to Birkenau after 35 years. And he says, was this a cruel thing of the Nazis, or was it planned that all the places of horror were done in the most beautiful, pristine places in Poland and Germany? He says, Dante, do nothing. Hell is a serene splendor that takes your breath away. You juxtapose beauty with horror. And then, of course, there's the time when the Nazis had the Jews play Bach while they're digging their own graves. How do you put Bach together with death? David wants integration, creation, life, and he can't make it happen. So that's his lament. Secondly, once you identify and can name grief, you need to move it through the soul. If grief stays bottled up, what happens is it freezes over. And if it freezes over, all your emotions freeze over, and you don't feel joy, you don't feel happiness, you don't feel sadness, you're numb. And David does not want people to be numb, so he designs a technique to move that grief, once identified, to get it out through tears. And he's a master at doing this. The thing that he uses to move the grief is the repetition of the refrain. And the refrain appears three times, but oddly, it doesn't happen at regular intervals. So he says it at the opening line, and then he waits almost to the end of the poem to repeat the refrain, and then does it immediately again. I'll tell you why. First refrain. Your glory, or gazelle, O Israel, lies slain on the heights, how the mighty have fallen. Fokelman writes, in the opening clause and the refrain, David does not mince matters for the length of one verse. You get this image of the land humiliated, deprived of its pride and ornament, the dead everywhere up there. It is, however, such a terrible sight to the poet, he cannot bear this for longer than one verse. Now, David has to take you, the audience, to a place you don't want to go, to Gilboa. Nobody wants to go to Gilboa to see what happened, but you have to go there. You're like a parent who has to go to the morgue to identify your son or daughter. So how does David get us to go to a mountain we don't want to go? The answer is he crafts an image filled with ambiguity, the very first word in the poem. And the Jewish audience, the Hebrews, don't know if David is writing about, the word in Hebrew is hatzavi, and has two meanings. It's crown or ornament, King Saul. It also means gazelle, that swift-footed gazelle, Jonathan. So you don't know, at the beginning of the poem, are we singing, is this a national lament in Washington, D.C., for President Kennedy, and we're all lamenting, or is David writing this to take care of his personal grief for his best friend, Jonathan? And you don't know until verse 25, when the lament's repeated, and the refrain's repeated, how the mighty have fallen, so he switched the lines, and now who's the Hatzavi? Jonathan. And now it slaps you in the face. We're staring at a dead gazelle, his brother, pierced through, slain, Jonathan. And the poignant irony is that he's fallen in the midst of what he did best, the battle. You know, he defeated over a dozen Philistines single-handedly. So with these striking blows to our soul, you're kind of tempted to turn away, but before you can collect your day's thoughts, the refrain quickly repeats again, thrusting us with amazing speed to the end of the poem, and we're forced to see it to the bitter end. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. By the way, James Garcia, our worship guy, put this to music, this whole, I think it's the best one he did of his Psalms album. If you'd like it, let me know, I'll send it to you. Now there's a stark finality, an eerie silence that death brings over the poet. So the image of the weapons of war perish evokes a number of memories from David's story. David's last act over a vanquished Goliath was to cut off his head and take his weapon as a trophy. When you have your enemy's weapons, the battle's over. And here the image reminds David of Saul's misplaced trust in his weapons, especially that impotent spear which never found its mark. If you ever have dinner with Saul in his dining room, there's bullet holes always in the wall where he's missed. And then Saul's sword, ironically, became the instrument of his own death. The weapons of war have perished, and by implication, so have those who trusted them. But the image is dual-edged. It's also a painful reminder of Jonathan, who is portrayed as the one who's always giving his weapons away. And he held nothing back in his loyalty to David. And he told David at the end, your destiny's this way. I got to go down with a sinking ship. That's my role. So could loyalty cost him his life? So the repetition of the refrain moves grief through the soul. And David is adamant that Israel's grief not get stagnant lest it petrify, encased in bitter walls of unfeeling. I've seen this happen again and again when people have a tragedy in their life and they haven't dealt with it, like a death of a family member. Then their dog dies and everything comes up. God will not let you get away with buried grief. The year our son and daughter died, it was almost as if every young pastor on the staff had healthy kids, and we had to look at that. You'd think God would be gracious. But he wants you to process grief. And you can't keep it buried. Now, as David spends his grief before others, before the throne of God, something very profound happens to him. Mysteriously, he is purged of his pain. Here's the gift of lament. First, he gives honor to King Saul. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned back. The sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. So here's the center of the poem. It's the eulogy, where one remembers a person at their best. Now, if you're honest, you may wonder how in the world David could say Saul was beloved and lovely. He was like Saddam Hussein. He slaughtered the whole priesthood. He's a murderer. He never acts one act of faith his whole life. And you're standing up there at his funeral saying, beloved and lovely. Is this hypocrisy, candy-coated adulation? You know, once I was at a funeral here, and I was out in the patio, and this old couple was going out. I guess I'm old now, too. But anyway, they were going out, and the guy says, Martha, were we at the right? Was that John we were thinking of? Was that? I don't think we were at the right funeral. But let me say something about funerals. Funerals are never the place to vent anger or hurt. that for 13 years, David vented his pain before the Lord. And God healed him. Because God ultimately was behind Saul. And so when he comes to this moment, he doesn't have an ounce of bitterness or hypocrisy in what he says. And he says, I can put one thing on the altar that Saul was good at. He was a good warrior. And he was, when he had the Holy Spirit, against his own will, obviously, but he had the Spirit, he defeated God's enemies. I can say that. And then you can take it as ambiguous, Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely. Well, is he talking about both of them or just Jonathan? He leaves it alone. But he does honor the king. But he does more than that. In verse 24, he loves the king. He gives them the gift of love. And this is the most healing thing you can do to your enemies. So we have a woman in our body who came to me last January after we had done Psalms and poetry. And one of our women shared for 2 years. She did poetry. She did Psalms therapy, we call it, to deal with the pain that her mother had caused. And this woman sat right in the front pew and she says, God, I'm going to give you 90 days. I'm not waiting a year. So she met with us and I have never heard such a litany of sexual abuse. Her mother was demon-possessed, literally. Her father was totally absent, traveling, gone. And so she started doing poetry, psalms, to purge herself of the pain. And the last thing she did with us is she wrote a letter to all those abusers by name. It was pretty emotional. These were guys at Menlo School and middle school. All the male guys were abusers. One guy followed her to Stanford during her Stanford years. So she named them all. And she forgave them. And she knew she had to for herself. But she couldn't have done that unless she had not done all this other work, asking God where he was, lament, giving a name to her grief. But this was the last poem she did. And this is what David does here. The thing that angered Saul his whole life was that David, he thought, had the adulation of women, and he didn't. Now, if you understood Hebrew poetry, that's the way you do Hebrew poetry. You put the king's name in the first line and the second guy in the second line. He says, Saul has slain the thousands, David the 10,000s. And then you do your numbers deal. You multiply by a thing in the second line. But through the lens of paranoia, Saul sees David as the enemy. So David says, hey, you want the adulation of women? You can have it at your funeral. I give it to you. Your daughters weep over him as he gave you the spoils of war. You can have the love of the daughters. I had something better. I had the love of your son. And now we come to the best gift. He says, I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. What the poem now does for David, and to me, this was the greatest gift poetry ever gave me. When Jonathan died, David was absent. Gilboa was desecrated. No one knows where God was. And for David, his whole life is filled with grief now. So every memory he used to have of positive of Jonathan are now cruel reminders for how he died. Then he writes this poem, and as he's delivering it, look what happens. Next slide. Jonathan's alive. He speaks to him in the first person, raises him from the dead. That's what happens in worship. Did you know that? Did you know that everybody that has gone before you in heaven, Hebrews says, when we gather for worship, they are present behind the earthly veil here in the room, not up in the sky. Heaven is another dimension, present with us. And when we worship, they're there, and you can speak to them. Secondly, David is fully present. And God's love is surrounding both of them. And Gilboa is now consecrated. So this is what my friend did. She went back to all those places where she had been sexually abused. She not only visited, she took pictures, brought it to us and put in a new song, put God in the equation, and sanctified those moments, every one of them, for 20 years. And now, instead of grief, it's turned into holy love. Now, the neat thing about the poem, once you write it, you can go there at any time, and the experience of the presence of God you have in reciting the poem in the presence of others is greater than when the event happened. Do you know that? It's wonderful. Now, if that isn't a gift. So, when we started the poem, those intensified cadences that drew us up to a time and place that we didn't want to go to a forbidden place, to a foreboding time where memories were marred by the tragic, lacerated by laws, now the tragic has been transformed into the sacred. And those poetic cadences and rhymes we once dreaded now fill us with hope, anticipation of life, beautiful life, holy life that we can relive again and again. So the poem creates a window into the sacred that transcends time, and it's a window that remains open forever. And where it ends us with is this holy love. And the word he used for Jonathan's love was pelah. That word in Hebrew is only used of God, who when he does something amazing, it's translated, it's wonderful, it's awesome, it's something only God can do. Like the Exodus is a pelah. The plural is nephalot, wonders. This is the only time it's used of a human being. What's sacred? When someone lays their life down for you so you can be king and takes your interest to such a height that their life they will expend for you, giving up their weapons, signing their will for you, being your voice to their father, being your advocate, and death. I always wondered how liberal scholars could say these guys were gay. First of all, they were soldiers. They never saw each other much. And David describes this love. This is not sexual love. He says it's better than romantic love. This is love that dies. This is holy love. And when you're loved that way, you're never the same. In 1989, the second year I went to Romania, the Securitate knew we were coming. My friend's house was now bugged. It was illegal to be in their homes. They didn't care. And the Securitate came to arrest me, and I happened to be out of the house, but all my stuff was in the house. So my friend, Jonathan, he gathered up the stuff, and all his whole goal was to find me, to give me a bedspread his wife handmade for me. He didn't care about being caught. The second week, we thought we were safe up in the hills, and the Securitate found we were there. Three times they burst into the camp. I really thought we were dead. And the Romanians burst up into a soccer game as a distraction, but they knew we were there. So over this 2 weeks, there were four men, happened to all be named Jonathan, who put their lives on the line for me that I wouldn't go down. And I thought one of them did. At one point, he was leading us out, and he was walking 500 yards ahead of us, and he was washing his feet by the stream. And so I snuck in because I wanted to get rid of my Romanian money. So I stuck it in his shoe, snuck back, and I saw the Securitate vehicle drive away, and he was gone. And I thought I gave him up. And for a minute, this horror came over me that I cost somebody their life. All of a sudden, he appeared through the forest, and I just started weeping. So processing grief is a wonderful thing. And the more you do it, the greater capacity you have for love. It's interesting. The poet's spiritual sons were named David and Jonathan. That was the name of my son. It was their children were the same age as the kids that I lost. So I say I lost two kids, but I gained a whole nation of kids. Not by going back, but by going forward through the grief out the other side. So grief increases your capacity to love. One of the most painful moments in my life was Friday, December 2nd, 1976. After David died, we Found out we're going to have a little baby girl. We had amniocentesis. Amniocentesis says she's healthy, so we took down the boy wallpaper, put up girl wallpaper, and she was born a beautiful little girl. Third night, she got sick, and Emily held her all night, knowing it was her last night with her daughter. She called me the next morning, and I was in shock. I went to the hospital, and all it took was one medical test to tell the whole story. It was the ammonia level, and I knew my daughter was going to die. Now I know the outcome. With David, we didn't know the outcome. She had the same enzyme deficiency as my son. So they took her to Stanford, and they pumped her full with protein to see how bad the thing was, and so her ammonia shot right up, and I went to see her. And I was with an elder who was a very good friend, and as I came out of the hospital, I was just overwhelmed with grief, and I wanted just to weep until my eyes ran dry. But I felt embarrassed, and I stuffed it, and I went home. So I called the hospital the next day, how my daughter was, and the nurse said, oh, she expired. Nobody told me. I wasn't there with her. I felt I'd never bonded with her, that I had abandoned her. The hospital said they'd take care of the body, which you think is a good thing, but it's a bad thing. So we never even had a service. At least with David, we had a memorial service. We'd have a service for Jessica. I just thought it was too morbid, and I couldn't do it again. But God was gracious. 16 years after that event, God called me back to my Gilboa. This is my Gilboa. Again, it was December, the same time as my daughter was sick, and it was raining. And there a precious boy from our church families was fighting for his life. And I went on Friday, and I watched this family grieve like they were teaching me how to grieve. They were crying, they were praying. I had just been studying this text. And then on Monday, I went back, and I started home, and the Lord said to me, turn your car around, and you need to go back to see what you've always missed. And though I'm a pastor, I have never seen anybody actually die. My whole wife's family died. Cancer, AIDS, the whole thing. We were caring for them. We missed it. We missed both our kids' death. So I went back with fear and trembling, went around Timmy's bed, and we held hands, and we sang, It Is Well With My Soul. And I didn't know the second verse. There was this beautiful black nurse who was a Christian. She boomed it out. And when she boomed out those words, angels came into the room. And we felt this peace, all of us, from top to bottom, in the midst of death. The sting was gone. And I watched Dawn hold her dead son and caress him for half an hour, loving him. Doing something I should have done. I watched the nurse wash his body like it was Jesus. And as we left, the Lord said to me, this is what you missed when you couldn't be with your daughter. I was there. So I said, okay, I know what I need to do. So the next Sunday I'm preaching, and I just did what David did. I used a church service to deal with my own personal grief. So the title of the message was about the Lord teaching us, or leading us. And it's leading you by the hand, and it's usually through danger, but at the end of the text, it's he leads you through death. And I wrote a poem to my daughter. I'd never done that before. I had bagpipes in the balcony. And through the powerful images, I was able to reconnect with her. And instead of grief, it became love. So I'll read it to you. Oh, Jessica, 9 months we waited for your precious hidden frame to break through the darkness and turn our souls into day. Unto us it was given, morning came, its dawn so bright it loosed our sackcloth and girded us with light. Your form so pure, yours the sweetest gaze, a mother's dream, a father's praise. Then on the third night, while I slept, you cried. Your mother held you tight. She knew, but it was hidden from me. All through the darkness, she cared for you and then gently laid you upon that altar. She knelt behind those well-hewn stones and wept. And then I heard the chauffeur's ringing cry. Terror-struck, impossible, I cried. Could it be to walk this way again, conception to pain, never to regain when the firstborn is already paid? I pulled back with Drew, traumatized by the pain I already knew. I could not stay and watch, for now I knew. My eyes could not gaze on your little tent, which would all too soon be broken down and laid to rest in the earth, rather than upon a breast. Waves of grief came crashing down. Heaven was calling through the rain. Pour out your heart like water. But I turned and left, numb from pain. Oh, Jessica, 9 months we waited for your precious hidden frame to break through the darkness and turn our souls into day. Oh, Jessica, where are you now? Where did the sower plant the seed? I long to know, but it's hidden from me. Oh, could I now go back in that dark hour relive when you lay limp and still? I would be your papa and give. I wanted to forget. It was easy to forget, but I could not forget. You, my first precious daughter, Jessica Lynn. 16 years passed, and in my wanderings here, I came across that valley again. It was raining. This time I didn't turn away, but obeying heaven's command, I knelt beside the stones and stayed until dawn's early light. Oh, holy night, angels sang, the grip of night grew limp. He appeared, and each soul felt its worth. He did not turn away, traumatized by pain, but stretched out his hand and placed it into the flame. Beyond his hand I saw the wrist impaled by my spear, pierced so deep with wounds, yet draws me near. Beyond his wrist, his gaze, oh, that gaze ablaze, with such love it burst my breast, evoking deepest praise. Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, grave, where is your sting? Captured with awe, I stared and stared, and then I knew that when I left, he had cared for you. Oh, Jessica, hardly your life clear forth of heaven was sent, ere it broke out into a smile and went. So swift your days, a gift to us was lent. You now a daughter and saint, inextricably blent, will one day teach your father in some heavenly tent. I've shared that poem maybe 50 times, different retreats. It never gets old. I can go back, talk to my daughter. But God was so generous with us, so my friend Jim Ziegler works at Alta Mesa Cemetery. And he found out my daughter's ashes were spread there. So he had a gravestone made for both my kids. And he put the verse on it that Ray Steadman sent me from Australia when my son died. I weep with you now, but joy comes in the morning. And he brought that to my home, and that's where it's at. So I have a place to go. And then I used to teach at Western Seminary, and of course I make the students write their own psalms. So one day, one of them stood up. Her name was Jessica. Blonde, like my daughter. I said, "What's your middle name, Jessica?" She goes, "Lynn." I said, "What year were you born?" She goes, 1976. I said, "What month?" "November." "What day?" "November 30." So she reads her poem, and the Lord quietly said, "Today you get to hear your daughter's voice." There's nothing like a dad getting to hear his daughter's voice. And we've had other sweet incidents, but then the capstone was 3 years ago. I'm 36 years out now, so 3 years ago we're at Lake Tahoe. The weekend before was Jim Ziegler's memorial. He died of ALS. We had the funeral here. The next day, I had to do this text again at Cupertino. And my friend Karen said, "When you read the poem, breathe. Let the Lord in." And so I did, and the Lord was special. And we were having communion, and my friend Jim Gatlin said, he brought a bouquet of flowers, and he says, "If you've had a blessing this week, take a flower from the altar and put it on the, or for the flowers and put it on the altar. If you've had a pain, bring a rock." Well, I just wanted to give thanks for how God has healed me. Wouldn't let any pain reside. And so there's this big, beautiful daisy about that big. And I took it out of the thing. And before I put it on the altar, I thought to myself, I just kissed it. And as I kissed it, the Lord said, "You just kissed your daughter. And I felt this palpable presence. And I was crying. I think, who can I tell that won't think I'm crazy? So I told my worship pastor, who's as crazy as me, I said, James, I just kissed Jessica. You know, and he gave me a big hug. So I thought, who is this God that so cares about us processing pain? He'd bring me here to get foundation. Send me all the way to Romania to find the gift of poetry. Bring it home to turn a bunch of engineers into poets so that nothing goes unsaid. And you know, it's so much cheaper than therapy at $150 an hour. I mean, I love counselors, I go to them, but this is a lot cheaper. And I think King David would just turn y'all loose. Because there's nothing more beautiful as a pastor. My passion used to be teaching. It's not anymore. I just want to prime the pump enough to get off the stage to hear everybody's voice, to hear the storytellers and poets. It's like a symphony. And so don't wait 16 years like I did. Give yourself a voice in the presence of God and others. Amen.